Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And that debt is fraud, and it is now or never. And please, please, we're asking you to help support the campaign of Jerry Wistrand. He is running for the state auditor for Missouri. Got so many things on my mind. We actually had a talk last night, and it seems like the irony is the incumbent is not showing up to many of these events. He's just having an agent of some kind here or there on travel. Now, I'm sure that his campaign is covering it, not the state of Missouri, but apparently they just wrapped up a big investigation that there were some findings, that there were problems, and the outcome from the auditor, the incumbent, was obey the law. Just a, not even a slap on the wrist, you know, no corrections, no requirements, recommendations. Obey the law. Now, I may be marginalizing that, but it's looking like, and as a matter of fact, I think there's talk about within his campaign of using the First Amendment petition. So if this happens, this will kind of unfold pretty quickly so that it can get done, get signatures, and start helping educate people as to what's going on within the Auditor's Office of Missouri. But that being said, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
It's great to have you. It's great for your contributions. And as a matter of fact, yesterday we were just diving into the 11th paragraph of Federalist Paper number 83, and we completely ran out of time. Now, this is going to be interesting because Hamilton is going to go through, and I'm amazed that I didn't confuse him with Madison this time. Hamilton, because I say Madison so often, it's just like it just rolls right off. We were talking about Madison all the time. Anyway, so Hamilton is going to provide some case, you know, some examples, you know, of, you know, of transferring property and so forth. But what he's going to do is he's going to lay out some jurisdiction. And so we want to highlight this because, as I recall, I believe he's going to actually accurately lay out the jurisdiction as to what would really be going into the federal court system. But I digress. Let's just take it one paragraph at a time. So 11, let's go ahead.
Let us suppose that by the laws of this state, a married woman was incapable of conveying her estate, and that the legislature, considering this as an evil, should enact that she might dispose of her property by deed executed in the presence of a magistrate. In such a case, there can be no doubt but the specification would amount to an exclusion of any other mode of conveyance. Because a woman having no previous power to alienate her property, the specification determined the particular mode which she is, for that purpose, to avail herself of. But let us further suppose that in a subsequent part of the same act, it should be declared that no woman should dispose of any estate of a detriment value without the consent of three of her nearest relations, signify by their signing the deed. Could it be inferred from this regulation that a married woman might not procure the approbation of her relations to a deed for conveying property of inferior value? The position is too absurd to merit a refutation, and yet this is precisely the position which those must establish who contend that the trial by juries in civil cases is abolished because it is expressly provided for in cases of a criminal nature.
Okay, so he's set the circumstances out, and he basically says, here's a case, and actually, I think what he's inferring is that the woman is actually trying to do a sell of property illegally by bypassing the family or what have you. But, you know, it's kind of vague circumstances. But let's keep going through this for paragraph 12.
From these observations, it must appear unquestionably true that trial by jury is in no case abolished by the proposed Constitution. And it is equally true that in those controversies between individuals in which the great body of the people are likely to be interested, that institution will remain precisely in the same situation in which it is placed by the state constitutions, and will be in no degree altered or influenced by the adoption of the plan under consideration. The foundation of this assertion is that the national judiciary will have no cognizance of them, and of course they will remain determinable as heretofore by the state courts only, and in the manner which the state constitutions and laws prescribe. All land causes, except where claims under the grants of different states come into question, and all other controversies between the citizens of the same state, unless where they depend upon positive violation of the Articles of Union by acts of the state legislatures, will belong exclusively to the jurisdiction of the state tribunals. Add to this that admiralty causes, and almost all those which are of equity jurisdiction, are determinable under our own government without the intervention of a jury, and the inference from the whole will be that this institution, as it exists with us at present, cannot possibly be affected to any great extent by the proposed alteration in our system of government.
Okay, so he basically laid it out that these types of cases will stay within the state court. Now, Madison does something very similar, but I think he's a little bit more firm in getting there, and it's pretty quick because Madison just kind of sums up, and I think he says something like 90 or 95% of almost all cases that are currently in the state court system will remain in the state court system, that they won't get into the federal court system. Now, let's go into the 13th paragraph. Go ahead.
The friends and adversaries of the plan of the convention, if they agree in nothing else, concur at least in the value they set upon the trial by jury, or if there is any difference between them, it consists in this. The government, the former regard it as a valuable safeguard to liberty. The latter represent it as the very palladium of free government. For my own part, the more the operation of the institution has fallen under my observation, the more reason I have discovered for holding it in high estimation, and it would be altogether superfluous to examine to what extent it deserves to be esteemed useful or essential in a representative republic, or how much more merit it may be entitled to as a defense against the oppressions of an hereditary monarch than as a barrier to the tyranny of popular magistrates in a popular government. Discussions of this kind would be more curious than beneficial, as all are satisfied of the utility of the institution and of its friendly aspect to liberty. But I must acknowledge that I cannot readily discern the inseparable connection between the existence of liberty and the trial by jury in civil cases. Arbitrary impeachments, arbitrary methods of prosecuting pretended offenses, and arbitrary punishments upon arbitrary convictions have ever appeared to me to be the great engines of judicial despotism, and these have all relation to criminal proceedings. The trial by jury in criminal cases, aided by the Habeas Corpus Act, seems therefore to be alone concerned in the question, and both of these are provided for in the most ample manner in the plan of the convention.
One of the things he mentions, and this, you know, right here, he's really not exposing stuff. I mean, he's just going through some of the perfunctory things that, you know, they're covering from the criminal aspect and so forth. He does mention this, though, as a defense against the oppressions of a hereditary monarch, then as a barrier. So he's, let me go ahead and go to the beginning of that paragraph, actually right here. And it would be altogether superfluous to examine to what extent it deserves to be esteemed useful or essential in a representative republic, or how much more merit would be entitled to it as a defense against the oppressions of a hereditary monarch than as to a barrier to the tyranny of popular magistrates in a popular government. Do you know what he means by a popular magistrate in a popular government?
Not really.
Yeah, I know.
About like federal district judges or something.
So technically, a magistrate is the, you know, under the British definition and under the British realm of magistrate back at this time. You know, because the doctrine of a lesser magistrate, because back in these days they had this magistrate and the doctrine of a lesser magistrate, and people going around teaching people about the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. Who is the lesser magistrate?
I have no idea.
Sheriffs. At least that's what the group out there, there's some groups out there that teach this. And the fact is that the magistrate itself is the king. The key or supreme magistrate of Britain is the monarch. There once was a time when magistrates were extended to the courts, and then there became a time after that magistrates then again started being referred to with the judges in a court, as you presumed. And so there is this real problem in the use of a magistrate. It's almost the same as when people just basically say a sovereign, because most people don't understand that there can be several different sovereigns regarding several different things. In other words, one would think, and in the context of the sovereign of all, would be God, our creator, sovereign of all things, of the universe and all things that exist within it. However, as we, you know, become, you know, focused in this world, we the people are sovereigns over our own things that we possess and control. And when we create a government, we delegate to it a level of sovereignty. The question is, how much sovereignty are we delegating? And so when that government is created, whoever has the ultimate say over the functions or decisions, such as, you know, all general powers, would be basically the king, monarch, or whomever. Now, in some cases, it might be a legislative body like a Senate. Or after the Revolutionary War, the magistrate became Continental Congress for the Union or for the Confederacy. So the point is that I could wander down all different directions and talk about what is a magistrate and get everybody confused, because it seems like anybody and everybody can be a magistrate, especially when you take context that the way the distribution of power under the Constitution, under the federal Constitution, state Constitution, and, you know, inalienable rights and powers, we can look at, well, the federal government is the sovereign over whether we go to war or not with a foreign nation. They have that full control. The state can't step in. We can't declare war. Only Congress can declare war. And specifically within the federal government, only Congress can declare war. Now, within the federal government, because they broke the magistrate, because the magistrate is the, you know, the ultimate say over all things government powers, it was broken up into three different bodies, or three different, legislative or branches, legislative, executive, and judiciary. So the legislative is considered the sovereigns because they create the law, they can take away law, and they can tax, I mean, and they can punish and determine punishments and so forth. They can even redress grievances. In other words, you go to them and say, this is just too much. This is destroying me. I'm going to lose my property and everything. They can waive everything for me. And, you know, on a case-by-case basis, they can redress a person or everybody's grievance, or a grievance that affects everybody, if that makes sense. So the point is that when we look at how the Constitution was framed, it divided the magistrate into the legislative and then the trial for justice for individuals was held by the courts, or I should say the judiciary. It had a very little function. There's no way they were magistrates. They were only magistrates over controversies and crimes, if that makes sense. And actually, most of the time, they weren't really the ones with the ultimate say. Because if it was a controversy, they were really just administrators. If it was a controversy of a crime, the jury, the trial by jury, the jury itself would be the ultimate determination on whether that person's guilty or not. Are you following me? Does this make sense? You know what? If it's confusing, I completely understand. Just because when it comes down to who, in every case and situation, who actually has the final say, that body or person is the sovereign for that one thing. And so when we look at, you know, your job or your business or what have you, and it's your business and you're the president, then you're the sovereign of that business. Unless you delegate, you know, to an accountant to take care of your finances. And 9 times out of 10, they have, fortunately, there's laws that kind of protect businesses from accountants stealing from them and those types of things. But the point is that it's, when we look at sovereigns, most people just really simplify these things, and it's not that simple. And when Hamilton uses or refers to that, without creating the context, I think it's very confusing. But the bottom line is that in a popular government, a popular magistrate would be a governor. It would be the president. When we look at our government today, we have a popular government where the democracy of electing a president, most people feel that they're empowering the president to do whatever he thinks necessary. In other words, we kind of have a monarchy, or we kind of have a executive where the executive has the full control and literally does that instead of following the Constitution. And we've been doing this since Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was probably the first populist government, or I should say populist president, and he was a very, I'll just say, big government guy because he grew government, and he did lots of interesting things, some things good, but most bad. But he was the string of kings. He was the beginning of that, where, you know, the people were electing presidents based on their agenda instead of looking at, you know, the limited functions of government. And this is why presidents are constantly pushing envelopes, doing things that they shouldn't do. From Wilson, you know, it really got bad when we got to Wilson and the progressive era. I mean, I can't skip over Lincoln. I mean, Lincoln, it really got bad there. Because Lincoln just took full charge. He took full charge of the country. And there was nobody that stopped him because he controlled the military, and the military was very loyal to him, or at least those that were protecting him were very loyal. So anyway, regarding this, though, this is really referring to the king and or an executive, because he's basically saying it out that or useful or essential, I should say, or essential in a representative republic, or how much more merit it would be entitled to as a defense against the oppressions of the monarchy or the barony, the barrier to tyranny by this populist president or this populist monarch, or not monarch, magistrate. My bad. So I'm not trying to confuse things. The point is that when people read this, most people would think judges. But technically, we're talking about the leaders, because I don't know many, and I don't think at any point in time there was anybody in the room that thought that the judges would be the popular selection of ruling the people. Now, back in Moses' time, that's what they used. They used judges, and that's how the government was set up. Through, you know, through Moses and his authority, he set up these judges, and the reign of judges for whatever, 400 years. But today, when he's talking about a popular government, the judges aren't necessarily at all the magistrate in this context. Does that make sense? So the question is, why is he proposing this other than he's just talking about these barriers and what would kind of be the outcome if all of a sudden these things were going to be, I'll just say, exploited or, you know, started to be subversive over, you know, the crimes. Because he talks later on about, and this is the interesting thing, he says arbitrary impeachments, arbitrary methods of prosecuting pretended offenses. And arbitrary is the definition. Arbitrary laws, arbitrary government, when they're doing arbitrary things, that is the epitome of tyranny. In a republic, in a republican form of government, it includes two key factors in the generic definition of a republican form of government. One is the government is based upon the representation, in a generic representation, of the people or another sovereign, such as the governments. Like in ancient Rome, the Senate was basically representing the states of Rome, of the empire, the states of the empire. It wasn't representing the people. Now, there are other cases where the people were represented and everybody hated, you know. And so the framers looked at, you know, they went down the path of representing the people right out the gate. And then they started realizing that maybe creating a mix between the two, that's why we covered that in the Constitutional Convention. By creating that mix, a bicameral legislative body, it became superior because you now can divide roles and create checks and balances. But the point is that when we look at a republican form of government, what is that second key factor for a republican form of government? Who is the king? Who is the executive? Who is the ultimate executive in a republican form of government? And that's, I'm not asking, this is more of a rhetorical question, because I know I've probably told you this, but whether you remember it or not, that's inconsequential. The other key factor in a basic generic understanding of a republican form of government, you got the representation, whichever it is, and then you have the rule of law, where the law is the king. So you create these laws, and these laws become fixed. And then you don't suffer from arbitrary, and you make it impossible for government to create arbitrary laws. The only way that they can create a law is going back to the sovereigns, the people, the Senate, and say, we need a new law. And we need a law to do this. And so they authorize what that new law would be, especially in our case, because we have an enumerated and very limited government. It's a huge mistake to give your government general powers so that they have full discretion of deciding what they're going to do. But I digress. In this particular case, he's basically talking, one, about this, and this is all coming from this trial by jury and so forth, and how government could actually start going sideways in whether it be a republican form of government or whether it be a monarch. It doesn't matter. But it does matter in context. If the republican form of government is based on limited powers, then they can't create arbitrary impeachments. They can't create arbitrary methods of prosecuting punishments and convictions and laws and so forth. They can't do it unless the people don't hold them accountable. The method in our framework, and the only thing that is going to change anything regarding the tyranny we're living in, is when the people stand up and start holding these people they are electing accountable. That's it. And the reason why we're dealing with all this arbitrary crap is because we're not holding them accountable and we're letting them get away with it. They're literally killing us. So anyway, with that, let's go into 14, 15, and then 16, because I think these kind of, he's got a thought going here. So let's go ahead and actually let's wait until the break. And when we come back from the break, how's that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. So folks, sorry for the confusing part on the magistrates, but the word does come up a lot. And so understanding what context, but the basic magistrate back at the time of the framers was the king. It wasn't the judges. As a matter, especially in America, because we kind of covered that yesterday. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Yeah, and so my apologies for taking more time from reading, but I think it was yesterday when I actually went through the different governments how I laid out how the courts and judges really weren't trusted, that the legislatures were the Supreme Courts and so forth at that point in time. And even Rhode Island didn't really have functioning courts and judges, you know, between the Articles of Confederation and going into the Constitution. I mean, they were in a big disarray. And so, I get information regarding Rogue Island all the time. And it just seems like there's a body of documents and information coming from all different types of sources. And it's a great feeding ground for misinformation. But that being said, the reality is that at this point in time, there may have been a paradigm in New York, because each state was its own culture. There may have been a paradigm regarding, you know, the judges and a magistrate, because the courts were independent in New York. Just to add to the confusion, he may be talking about that, but I believe that when you're talking about a popular government, that means that the people are choosing their leader, and that the leader basically sets the tone and has agendas, what have you. And that's why they choose the leader, because they're kind of like a Hitler or, you know, a despot, whatever, a dictator instead of a monarch. But the point is that at this point in time, when they created this constitutional framework, the judges or the courts were not elevated as the supreme body of magistrates. Now, let me ask you this, Sean. If you were a judge, and you kind of knew, this was back in those days, you kind of knew that the court just had a bad rap, right? They weren't considered this almighty, powerful magistrate because they were only administratively sitting over controversies. And 9 times out of 10, if all of those controversies, if not, you know, maybe a few exceptions, these controversies were literally being settled by the people in trials by jury, then you're really just an administrator. You see my point?
Yes, sir.
And so how do you change that unless you really, and I would believe that, you know, it's kind of like how beef ranchers work together across the nation. They get organized. It's like unions and like other professions and so forth, and like the same thing with technology. Companies get together, people in a market space, they start working together. How can we improve our image? Well, why wouldn't we think that back in those days, the courts wanted to aggrandize themselves and obtain more power? Let me ask you this. Who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want to have, you know, a more prestigious, you know, perspective or be more prodigious within the eyes of society? In other words, they look up at you like you're E.F. Hutton, like you're the, you know, the cat's meow on the law. And I'm here to tell you that that is innate within everybody. I think everybody wants to see, even Adam Smith said this in The Wealth of Nations, that it is innate in every person to try to create a better condition for their children. In other words, when we look, you know, throughout the annals of history, the average family is, I mean, mom and pa, or mom and pa, keep it mom and pa, are working and endeavoring to try to create a better opportunity and to have ensure that their children have a better stake in life than they did. Is that not the average? I mean, we've got a lot of people that are really illiterate and just never been taught and become really problematic. And yeah, it's epidemic. You know, ignorance can be an epidemic. And I think we're facing that today as a society, but that's never not the point. The point is it is innate that people have that desire. And Adam Smith kind of pointed to that. So I think that that innate desire of making things better for yourself and for your children is this driving factor. And it helps lend to why and how the courts have gotten into the position they are today.
I think that if you lack integrity, then you're not really making things better for your children. You're just making them to be able to be as prideful as you were. I guess my take on what you said is it shouldn't matter whether you're prestigious when you're a position of authority like that. It depends on your character. If you have integrity, then you're going to do the right thing that's right for the law and your progeny. If you're just looking to increase your status and your standard of living, then I think that lacks integrity when you're talking about looking for prestige.
Yeah, so the lack of morals, the lack of education, you know, the self. I mean, we see parents today that they're not actually trying to make life better for their kids. They're actually using their kids. This started in the 60s. When the federal government started creating a welfare system for homeless or fatherless families so that they could give more money rewarding fatherless families. So the mom, the baby, you know, creator, or the, you know, whatever, the boom, she gets pregnant. She gets the dad out of the home because she can have more and more, and now she's making money. And it becomes a way of supporting yourself and using kids to do that. And so it creates these crises. And these types of things actually become perpetuated because, you know, we get brought up in, you know, we kind of, kids kind of do what their parents do, or they make the same mistake. They may, in their head, say, I want to do the right thing, but they end up not doing the right thing. They, like you said, they lack the morals, the integrity, or what have you. We got our share of problems. When you actually have people, cognitive people, that, you know, have a level of morality, a level of you know, education and or, you know, they understand the responsibility of being a parent, all these things. And I think that that's when, because it wasn't an epidemic or a systemic problem in Britain in 1776, where, you know, people were, you know, abusing. Now, actually, let me back up. In 1776, in John Adams's journal, when he went to France, There was an orphanage. He went to one, and there were several orphanages in Paris. And he went to one, and he goes, my goodness, there are more, and I don't think he, you know, used an expletive, there are more children in this orphanage than there are orphans in the United States right now. And there are more people in the United States than there are in Paris. So he's basically looking at, you know, what the heck's going on? Why is this set, you know, this is where they started losing their morals. This is when they stopped going to church. This is when they started cutting the heads off of, just a couple of years later, 20 years or so, they started cutting the heads off of the church leaders and the political leaders and so forth. This is when they actually stopped, you know, going to church. This is when they became godless and so forth. But it was an indictment of society. But when you look at Britain wasn't that way. Britain wasn't at the turning point of becoming godless. And so when Adam Smith looked at society or his culture, he saw this. And I do believe that there are these innate things that if circumstances are right, but, you know, you give somebody a bad circumstance and next thing you know, they just go sideways. Doesn't mean it's not innate there.
What about the people that are creating the systems that perpetrate and facilitate the paradigm you're talking about? They have money. They have supposedly education.
Yeah.
But I would say that the morals are very much in question.
They've succumbed to this ultimate desire of ultimate power, ultimate control, ultimate wealth. You know, this avarice, greed, what have you. I was going to say something else.
Psychopathy.
Yeah, so there was another thing I was going to say, though, regarding these innate things. I believe it is also innate within all men to want to know our origins, to try to seek from whence we came. This desire to, you know, why am I here? You know, the duality of man, these profound questions that we propose or, you know, we think in our heads, it is, I think every person goes through that. I think lots of people spend a lot of time suppressing it because they just don't want to know the answer. And as a matter of fact, those people are usually caught up in the same kind of problem, whether it's control or whether it's addiction, whatever it is, you know, because nobody wants to make themselves feel bad because they're not doing the right thing. But I do believe it's the same thing that leads all people to start, you know, receiving, looking for, and then accepting the truth of the gospel and so forth. So anyway. I think that's innate, too. I think these things are kind of planted into our the way our mind works, what have you. It's just this natural thing. And who knows?
It's written on our hearts.
Yeah,
it's
and actually,
us whether we accept it or reject it.
And without, you know, going into Sunday school, there's probably a lot to be said for the Spirit working on us as well. And driving us to do good things. But anyhow, let's now that we're about 9 minutes into this episode, let's do paragraph 14, 15, 16, kind of working through these ideas, 14 through 17. Okay? Thanks.
It has been observed that trial by jury is a safeguard against an oppressive exercise of the power of taxation. This observation deserves to be canvassed. It is evident that it can have no influence upon the legislature in regard to the amount of taxes to be laid, to the objects upon which they are to be imposed, or to the rule by which they are to be apportioned. If it can have any influence, therefore, it must be upon the mode of collection and the conduct of the officers entrusted with the execution of the revenue laws. As to the mode of collection in this state, under our own Constitution, the trial by jury is in most cases out of use. The taxes are usually levied by the more summary proceeding of distress and sale, as in cases of rent. And it is acknowledged on all hands that this is essential to the efficacy of the revenue laws. The dilatory course of a trial at law to recover the taxes imposed on individuals would neither suit the exigencies of the public nor promote the convenience of the citizens. It would often occasion an accumulation of costs more burdensome than the original sum of the tax to be levied. And as to the conduct of the officers of the revenue, the provision in favor of trial by jury in criminal cases will afford the security aimed at willful abuses of a public authority to the oppression of the subject and every species of official extortion are offenses against the government for which the persons who commit them may be indicted and punished according to the circumstances of the case.
That's an interesting compare and contrast, because I wouldn't use that. I wouldn't use those two cases, because taxes is a necessity of government. And excessive taxes is due to excessive spending, not due to, you know, anything else. So the question is, was the excessive spending within the parameters of powers granted, or were they spending on things they had no authority to spend? This is why I say that debt is fraud. Our taxes would be more than palatable. I don't think people would have a problem, because I don't think we would be paying any federal taxes. I mean, prior to Wilson taking office and, you know, starting to really open up the Treasury and spending money and his pursuit of buying America's way into prosperity. And so prior to that, the revenue that paid for the federal government came in through imposts. And at that point in time, America was self-consuming. In other words, we were buying pretty much our own food. We were buying pretty much most of our own products and those types of things. There was very little that we were, you know, dependent on imports. We brought in things, and whatever we brought in was paying for that federal government. Now, to be honest, there were other mechanisms and revenues that were being used, like selling state land unconstitutionally. Clearly, the federal government was pocketing that, because they still were holding on to these big lumps and clumps of land that they had no authority to hold on to. But technically, by this point in time, by the early 1900s, the federal government was really out of business of trying to sell that, and they were harboring that and holding on to that as if it was a part of their wealth. If you look at, you know, their balance sheet, it was listed over there in their assets, and it should never have been there. They had no authority to possess that land. Be that what it is, when we look at how at that point in time, we were not the world's consumer like we are today. I mean, we have trade deficits with almost every nation. You know, Japan, Europe, I mean, many nations in Europe, we're buying or bringing in, you know, all sorts of goods. And we're the consumers of all sorts of world crap. And so it's kind of like we're the... Yeah, I guess that's the best way of labeling it. I see America as the buyer of foreign goods, the primary buyer. We're buying and buying and buying. And we're buying stuff that has no imposts on it. We went to this idea of basically, you know, we don't put, you know, taxes on our stuff. And so we're buying from these foreign nations their stuff without taxing it, what we call free trade. Well, guess what? Europe got wise and everybody else got wise years and years ago, even Japan, and started putting taxes on the stuff that was being sold abroad. The value-added tax, the VAT tax in Europe, I think, what is it, about 20% now, easily, 20% plus. And that pays for their vacations. It pays for all sorts of things. We're paying that, but we're not laying any taxes upon the goods that are coming with that. And I'm just telling you folks that we have been subsidizing the, you know, this good time, this party, and the takeover of communism by our insatiable, by our great productivity and our insatiable desire to have everything. If you look at America, even the poorest people in America live in, you know, almost opulence compared to most people in the world. They have air conditioning, you know, they eat out. They eat out a bunch of junk, but and this is all because they're being subsidized as well. But nevertheless, my point is that he's talking about, you know, this tax and comparing taxes to a trial by jury and crimes. And it's a terrible, terrible compare and contrast or comparison in this. I would just look at taxation as literally the necessity of government, and when you're paying way too much taxes, then you have to look at how much they're spending, and that's always the problem. That's what the problem with every state. The state of Washington is going bankrupt because they're spending. They can't spend enough money. They're deliberately trying to, the Cloward Piven? They're trying to literally break the system. California's doing the same thing. So, anyway, it's interesting that he talks about, you know, and compares this with the trial by jury. But I have a hard time in trying to understand what he's trying to create in context of this, other than the fact that this trial by, it's just defending the point of a trial by jury. And it's not like he's misleading anything. It's just like, the fact of the matter is the trial by jury was one of the keys that was, you know, argued in the ratification debates. And the people, the anti-federalists, didn't like it. But the way it was described, it was maybe not preferred, but maybe at least it was palatable. Because when you look at what was being delegated to the federal government in their jurisdiction, most people had no worries about ever having to step into a federal court at that point in time based on these limited and defined powers. That was it. And I think that's why it got ratified, why the Constitution was ratified with, you know, hardly, I would just say, without any real pushback. I mean, there's not one state that didn't ratify it. There was only one state, New Hampshire, that met and didn't ratify. They said, well, let's wait. And actually, North Carolina did that as well. But let's move into paragraph 18. Thanks.
The excellence of the trial by jury in civil cases appears to depend on circumstances foreign to the preservation of liberty. The strongest argument in its favor is that it is a security against corruption, as there is always more time and better opportunity to tamper with the standing body of magistrates than with the jury summoned for the occasion. There is room to suppose that a corrupt influence would more easily find its way to the former than to the latter. The force of this consideration is, however, diminished by others. The sheriff, who is the summoner of ordinary juries, and the clerks of courts, who have the nomination of special juries, are themselves standing officers and acting individually, may be supposed more accessible to the touch of corruption than the judges, who are a collective body. It is not difficult to see that it would be in the power of those officers to select jurors who would serve the purpose of the party as well as a corrupted bench. In the next place, it may fairly be supposed that there would be less difficulty in gaining some of the jurors promiscuously taken from the public mass than in gaining men who had been chosen by the government for their probity and good character. But making every deduction for these considerations, the trial by jury must still be a valuable check upon corruption. It greatly multiplies the impediments to its success. As matters now stand, it would be necessary to corrupt both court and jury, for where the jury have gone evidently wrong, the court would generally grant a new trial. And it would be in most cases of little use to practice upon the jury unless the court could be likewise gained. Here then is a double security, and it will readily be perceived that this complicated agency tends to preserve the purity of both institutions. By increasing the obstacles to success, It discourages attempts to seduce the integrity of either. The temptations to prostitution which the judges might have to surmount must certainly be much fewer, while the cooperation of a jury is necessary, than they might be if they had themselves the exclusive determination of all causes.
So what are your thoughts?
I think they're both can be corrupted.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it would be easier to corrupt a bunch of judges that are there for life than it would be to corrupt, you know, juries that are made up by anonymous, not anonymous, but random people, different people all the time.
Yeah.
And also you get a more, realistic view of what the public body is, you know, what they're, I don't know how you would describe it, but how they feel about different things.
Right. So I think that the judges are easily corruptible because the money involved. And I believe that another form, at least on the federal side, that they're more, even more corruptible because it is a permanent position. You can't take it from them. So as long as they don't get caught, you know, they can, you know, they can work it. But
and the people who are supposed to be holding them accountable benefit from their decisions. So you have like a built-in corruption or corruptibility, because if they make a decision about what Congress is doing or what the president is doing, then the Congress and the president are going to have means and a motivation to try and skew that or influence that in a way.
Yep, and on the court and on the jury side, we've seen juries ignore the law and delve out what we would call jury nullification based on social justice, like the O.J. Simpson trial. So what do we do?
But that's where when he talks about the court and the jury, you have like two. It's in no system is going to be perfect, just like you're saying with the O.J. Simpson trial. But then when they go into civil court, he gets slammed and they say, yeah, he killed her. But it's not criminal. It's civil. So it's about money instead
right.
of actual crime.
Right. So can you find justice, true justice? Because the whole point of the criminal trial is to hold a criminal, an alleged criminal, fully accountable to the extent of the law. And so the real question is, can you actually do that in America when we've got these racial boundaries to where, you know, they will never convict their own or that type of thing? I mean, there are these challenges that we're facing, and we're obviously out of time here too. So maybe we can, if you want to, we can do this as a go back, but there's obviously more to read on, but I just see that we do have an uphill climb. How do we get a system to basically eradicate, at least on the jury side, as well as, and there's methods of probably doing it on the court side as well, but that's for another day. And so I'm G.R. Mobley, and we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help, and we'll be back with more of Hamilton's undermining the Constitution through these Federalist Papers. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.